And now Flora is here. Hi, Flora. Flora Lichtman with our video pick of the week.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there. Got a good one, I'm sure.
Yes, it's the highly anticipated Golfing with an Astronaut video.
Oh, was I waiting for that? We promoed that last time.
Yes, we did. And here it is. We've delivered.
You golf, playing golf with an astronaut. But this is not on the big link someplace.
No, right? It's actually, and it's even better, it's mini golf.
Wow. You played mini golf with an astronaut.
I mostly filmed, but but an astronaut did play mini golf with us, kind of. And it's not just any mini golf. The New York Hall of Science in Queens on the 7 train has built and opened this summer a mini golf course that is space themed.
Wow.
So every hole has a scientific lesson associated with it.
Like gravity and rocketry and things like that?
Yeah, exactly. So what, you know, hole number 3 I think is launch window. And so you can read a little bit about, you know, what the launch window is, and then the hole itself represents that by having a metal grate that the kids we were playing with had a very hard time mastering. And I would have too. I mean,
it was funny.
It's a tough hole.
It's funny. It's a video pick of the week on our website at sciencefriday.com. And the astronaut walked you through the mini golf course.
Yes.
Explaining this to you.
He was very generous.
Who was he?
It's Charles Camarda. And he flew on Discovery a couple of years ago on the return to flight mission, which was after the Columbia disaster. So,
right.
You know, that's kind of a brave thing to do anyway.
Yeah.
And he explained some of the science as we went along.
It's very funny to see. You know, it's cute. It's a theme park. It's at the New York Hall of Science in Queens, and it teaches you about rocketry, the physics, while you're launching that golf ball around the loop-de-loops and almost hitting certain people.
Yes, there are a few close calls in the video. Look out for a little montage where a few people almost get smacked in the head. And, you know, our astronaut, Dr. Camardo, was pretty good. I mean, he tied for first with one of the kids.
Is that with one of the kids? So simple, even a kid can do it. But it's a lot of fun, and thank you for putting your life in jeopardy. Because I saw someone of those angles that you got with the golf balls there.
Yeah, some were close. And I'd be curious if people have mini golf courses that are sort of science-y in their neighborhoods. We'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, maybe they can shoot their video, send it to us.
Yeah, that'd be great.
If you can do your own video of a science-y theme at your own mini golf course.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be mini golf. I mean, you know, amusement park.
Yeah, amusement park. You know, that maybe at mini golf, why that little windmill gets in the way just when you... I don't know.
Yeah, the physics.
The physics of all that stuff. Thank you.
Thanks.
Flora Lichtman, our video pick of the week at the mini golf science video there on sciencefriday.com. It's a lot of fun. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. That's about it for this program. It's produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berkowitz is our director, and Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher is our SciArts producer. Our intern is Eric Ortlip. Neil Roush is our technical director. And Manya is at the controls here in New York. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbett, and the University of Denver. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting still. And Second Life folks are hanging out. You can go to Second Life, too. And we want to also give credit for Shelley Du Bois, who is joining us now for the first time. Welcome aboard as part of the crew of Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatto in New York.
On the shelves of many discount toy stores, you can find products containing lead. Children's health advocates say that some of the toys have dangerously high levels, despite a new federal law to protect children. Juan Ha of member station KQED in San Francisco reports.
Vroom, 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 vroom.
When 3-year-old David Blair was still in his crib, he loved to suck on vinyl cubes from the Baby Einstein Company, the kind that are supposed to help kids get smarter. His parents, Kim and Raymond, didn't think much of it until tests showed lead concentrations in his blood were double what doctors consider a tolerable range. Lead can cause serious harm to a child's brain development.
We were mortified. I was scared and feeling like that maybe we were bad parents and we weren't taking care of our child well enough.
tests of soil, paint, and drinking water from their San Francisco Bay Area home came back negative for lead. The only item that tested positive was the baby Einstein cube. In fact, it turned out to be on the federal toy recall list because of its high lead content. David's father, Raymond Blair, doesn't think the government is doing enough to protect consumers.
You know, you get angry because you realize there's a lot of products out on the market that aren't safe. And you think that someone should be checking that or making sure that we're not exposed to that.
Someone is trying to make sure kids aren't exposed. But the problem is enforcement is lax right now. A new consumer product safety law went into effect last February that makes it illegal to sell toys and other children's products if the lead content exceeds 300 parts per million. The law also requires items to be certified by third-party labs. But here's the loophole. The certification requirement has been delayed until 2010 to give manufacturers and laboratories time to prepare. So how assured can consumers be that products for kids don't exceed the lead limits? NPR member station KQED and a Berkeley nonprofit, Center for Environmental Health, shopped at 14 discount store locations in California, including this one in Orange County. At all but two stores, we purchased children's products that exceeded the new federal lead limit. Of the couple hundred products we tested, toys, jewelry, and everyday items like rain ponchos, about one in six exceeded the limit. At this store, For You Bargain, a child's backpack that KQED purchased tested three times above the lead limit. Owner Frank No was surprised.
I bought this maybe 2 years ago, maybe. The importer has to test, I think.
Like many of the other small store owners, No says he's not aware of the new lead standards.
So this is the metal star-shaped zipper from the CD case, and he will be cutting into smaller pieces.
A technician at MACS, the laboratory that conducted testing for KQED, is getting a hot pink CD case ready for a lead test. The case, purchased at Dollar Discount in Newark, is branded with a name many families know well and trust, Disney. And it features the cast of the popular movie High School Musical. These test results show the zipper contains six times the legal lead limit. A Disney spokesman says the company requires manufacturers of Disney-licensed products to provide lab results showing merchandise meet current federal standards. But problems can occur later on, after a product passes, according to the spokesman and consumer advocates. Disney says though it spot checks merchandise, it relies on manufacturers to make sure it's compliant. Many larger retail chains, including Walmart, Toys R Us, and Target, have beefed up their lead testing programs and already require manufacturers to provide third-party lab results. But the government's delay of the certification requirement may allow smaller stores and some discount chains to skirt the law.
Without certification, then there's no guarantee.
Don Mays oversees product safety at the nonprofit Consumers Union in New York. He says the law mandating stricter lead limits doesn't have much teeth behind it right now.
If the law is not being enforced, then the stores can put products on the market unchecked. And that, to me, is a serious problem.
He and other consumer advocates say the federal agency responsible for enforcing the law, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, is stretched way too thin, with few inspectors to enforce tens of thousands of different kinds of products. Spokesman Scott Wolfson says all retailers and manufacturers are expected to follow the law, despite the government stay requiring certification.
It's very serious for somebody to not be compliant. These limits were put into place to give parents more confidence when they go shopping. We know that there are probably products out there that violate this new law. We're ready to act, but we need that information brought to our attention.
Consumer advocates worry that problems are bigger at discount stores, which don't seem to have as rigorous programs to weed out leaded merchandise. Again, Don Mays of Consumers Union.
The dollar stores are far less likely to scrutinize their shipments in that way. It's expensive for them. The whole idea with these stores is to keep the price as low as possible.
And until the testing and certification requirement kicks in next year, it's buyer beware. For NPR News, I'm Juan Ha in San Jose, California.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Families who took vacations this summer might have used portable technology to keep the kids quiet, like iPods or back-of-the-seat DVD players. License plate game, after all, can get just a little old after a while. But there's a reliable distraction that's been around for decades, the Yes and No books. That's No as in K-N-O-W. Paul Collins, Weekend Edition's literary detective, joins us from the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting. Paul, thanks very much for being back with us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Now, remind us what the Yes and No book is.
Well, these are the invisible ink books that you find in gift shops at airports or train stations, and they come with a little decoder pen, and they have invisible ink games on them that you then apply the pen to develop the page. So you can play tic-tac-toe or hangman.
What's the invisible ink?
At its most basic level, it's kind of like litmus paper. Mm-hmm. You basically have a treated ink that is invisible on the paper, but is then developed by a chemical developer in the pen.
How long have these been around?
Well, these first started in the early 70s. And in fact, it was brought about by a guy named Leon Lenkoff. And he patented this idea back in 1974. You know, like many parents, this summer I bought one of these because we had a trip coming up and I needed to keep my kids occupied. And after getting it, I kind of got intrigued. I wanted to know where it came from.
Now, do I understand this correctly that B.F. Skinner has, if not exactly something to do with these books, something to do with the concept?
Yeah, that was one of the things that surprised me when I started digging into this about where these books came from. I tracked it down to Leon Lenkoff, and looking at his patent application, he cited a previous patent by a guy named Burhus Franklin Skinner. And it took a moment for that to sink in. I looked at it and I went, B.F. Skinner. And sure enough, there was a previous patent from 1968 that B.F. Skinner had filed where his idea was basically having self-correcting worksheets in the classroom. For example, for teaching handwriting, you could have people staying within the lines by having the paper treated so that if they went outside the lines as they were practicing their letters, the paper might turn, you know, red, for example. Skinner was really fascinated by this idea of kind of automating learning and having teaching machines. And so this idea actually fit into that. And Lenkoff's kind of intuitive leap was to look at this kind of odd and obscure teaching technology that Skinner was developing and to think, huh, I bet you could play tic-tac-toe using this.
Now, has this – I hate to refer to this as technology. It's so fundamental. But has it been used in other dimensions?
Well, it has. That's the strange thing about it is that these yes and no books are so sort of retro in appearance. They haven't changed the artwork in them in decades. And so they're very kind of charming in that way. But in fact, they've turned up in a really kind of unexpected place lately, which is for securing ballots in elections. Mm. Specifically, there's a group being led by a cryptographer named David Chaum, and he's a guy that was one of the pioneers of electronic cash. And he's now been leading this group into developing a system called Scantegrity. Basically, it's using these decoder pens, the exact same kind you use in these games, and you use them on your ballot to fill in like an optical scanner bubble. And when you do that, not only does it develop the bubble to indicate your choice, it also shows a confirmation code inside the bubble, like, say, an alphanumeric code or just a couple of letters that you can then write on a detachable stub and then later on use to confirm that your vote was counted.
Oh, my gosh. So the same technology that keeps indolent children from getting bored can one day keep the Supreme Court from having to settle an election.
You know, the strange thing too, I mean, it's such an unexpected way to be using this. But, you know, this actually started as a chemistry professor back in the 50s trying to do these chemistry quizzes for students filling in bubbles on these forms. So it's kind of come full circle in that sense. You know, this has actually been tested out in a mock election in Tacoma Park, Maryland, back in April. And they're actually going to use it in their municipal election this November. And one of the curious things about this is it might have been kind of a hard sell to their Board of Elections, this new and untested technology, except that everybody actually recognized it from their own childhoods.
So you have to trust
the yes and no pens.
From the yes and no pen, yeah. LaPaul Collins, our own Yes and No Man, our literary detective here on Weekend Edition. Paul, very nice to talk to you.
Oh, good talking with you.
And now Flora is here. Hi, Flora. Flora Lichtman with our video pick of the week.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there. Got a good one, I'm sure.
Yes, it's the highly anticipated Golfing with an Astronaut video.
Oh, was I waiting for that? We promoed that last time.
Yes, we did. And here it is. We've delivered.
You golf, playing golf with an astronaut. But this is not on the big link someplace.
No, so it's actually, and it's even better, it's mini golf.
Wow. You played mini golf with an astronaut.
I mostly filmed, but but an astronaut did play mini golf with us, kind of. And it's not just any mini golf. The New York Hall of Science in Queens on the 7 train has built and opened this summer a mini golf course that is space themed.
Wow.
So every hole has a scientific lesson associated with it.
Like gravity and rocketry and things like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, exactly. So what, you know, hole number 3, I think, is launch window. And so you can read a little bit about, you know, what the launch window is. And then the hole itself represents that by having a metal grate that the kids we were playing with had a very hard time mastering. And I would have, too. I mean,
it was funny.
It's a tough hole.
It's funny. It's our video pick of the week on our website at sciencefriday.com. And the astronaut walked you through the mini golf course.
Yes.
Explaining this to you.
He was very generous.
Who was he?
It's Charles Camarda. And he flew on Discovery a couple of years ago on the return to flight mission, which was after the Columbia disaster. So,
right.
You know, that's kind of a brave thing to do anyway.
Yeah.
And he explained some of the science as we went along.
It's very funny to see. It's cute. It's a theme park. It's at the New York Hall of Science in Queens, and it teaches you about rocketry, the physics, while you're launching that golf ball around the loop-de-loops and almost hitting certain people.
Yes, there are a few close calls in the video. Look out for a little montage where a few people almost get smacked in the head. And, you know, our astronaut, Dr. Camardo, was pretty good. I mean, he tied for first with one of the kids.
with one of the kids. So simple, even a kid can do it. But it's a lot of fun, and thank you for putting your life in jeopardy. Because I saw some of those angles that you got with the golf balls there.
Yeah, some were close. And I'd be curious if people have mini golf courses that are sort of science-y in their neighborhoods. We'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, maybe they can shoot their video, send it to us.
Yeah, that'd be great.
If you can do your own video of a science-y theme at your own mini golf course.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be mini golf. I mean, you know, amusement park.
Yeah, amusement park. You know, that maybe at mini golf, why that little windmill gets in the way just when you, I don't know.
Yeah, the physics.
The physics of all that stuff. Thank you.
Thanks.
Flora Lichtman, our video pick of the week at the mini golf science video there on sciencefriday.com. It's a lot of fun. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. That's about it for this program. It's produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berkowitz is our director, and Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher is our SciArts producer. Our intern is Eric Ortlip. Neil Roush is our technical director, and Manya is at the controls here in New York. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting still, and Second Life folks are hanging out. You can go to Second Life, too. And we want to also give credit for Shelley Du Bois, who is joining us now for the first time. Welcome aboard as part of the crew of Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
NPR's Robert Benincasa has been looking at another report put out by the Labor Department, one that tracks hiring, firing, and quitting. What are you finding out in there?
Well, it's this other report, and it's called JOLTS. And JOLTS stands for Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. Even in a recession, there are millions of people getting hired every month. So in June, there were almost 3.8 million people hired. So that's not as many as before the recession, but there still are opportunities out there.
In a way, though, it does seem strange to hear it. Frank Langford says, well, it's bad. You're saying there's a chance. You know, you can go out there and get a job.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds counterintuitive. I talked to John Haltewanger. He's an economist over at the University of Maryland. He tells me that about half these hires are just a normal turnover in the labor market, someone leaving a job and someone replacing them. The other half, though, he says, really represents businesses that are doing well despite the larger economy.
Right.
And in terms of the layoffs, you know, the layoffs continue, but they may have peaked in the spring. And, you know, of course, the hope is that they'll start to drop off more dramatically in the future.
Well, how would somebody know out there, somebody who's really stopped looking for a job, that indeed some people are hiring, some sectors are hiring workers?
Well, I mean, it's difficult. Of course, it's difficult to find out. The pockets of prosperity that the economist was talking about, they exist all over the labor force and across sectors, across regions. We do know that over the summer, we saw some improvements in home building. We saw some improvements in manufacturing. And today's employment situation report showed that there were some small amount of jobs added in the education and health services sector.
Okay, so the jobs are there. What do the professionals say about how to wake up some morning, perk up, and go out and actually find
right.
something that you hadn't been thinking about?
Right. Well, the job recruiters say one of the first things to do is to look at your skill set and think about how those skills might translate to another industry. So someone who is a good salesperson might find that they're good at marketing. And someone who's done web servers for a corporation might be able to do the same kind of thing for a nonprofit. One of the hardest things, really, is that people who are in the workforce now are pretty reluctant to quit. So the number of job openings remains pretty small. You know, when times are good, over 3% of the jobs in the economy are open. You know, right now, it's about 2%.
2%. Another factor in that, talking about people who are actually working, it seems they feel that they have to work harder, really sort of improve their job performance just to hang on to that job.
Right, and the data bear that out. Productivity has actually gone up, even though the overall workforce is smaller. So this Labor Day, we have a smaller, productive workforce doing more work.
NPR's Robert Benincasa, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And to mark Labor Day, we've launched a multimedia feature on our website. It's called The Way We Work. You can see and hear people talk about their work and what it means to them.
Got a 2000 Ford truck. How many miles here? We get 10,000 on. How many get 10 to 10?
Mostly people are very interested to know that midwives are still working. They're still doing that.
One of the things that I do notice by keeping a job, paying bills, taking care of my son, is people look at me as a different individual. They smile. They accept me. They I'm so proud of you.
Stories about the way we work at the new NPR.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Noah Adams. Exercise can be hard on the joints. At least that's a common perception. Make that misperception. Several recent studies suggest that moderately intense weight-bearing exercises, including long-distance running, do not increase the risk of arthritis. NPR's Allison Aubrey has details.
Physician Harvey Simon is 67 now, but back in college he earned the ironic nickname Gazelle, thanks to his running style.
I'm reasonably lean, but I'm uncoordinated and clumsy. My running stride is something awful to look at. But I haven't missed a day of running since October 30th, 1978.
After clocking a little over 100,000 miles in these years, Simon says his knees and hips are no worse for the wear.
I may be lucky. I may be genetically gifted in that way, but my joints are fine.
So is Harvey Simon an anomaly? Isn't all that pounding bound to do some damage? Consider this, and these are figures Simon quotes. Every time a runner strikes the ground, he or she applies 8 times their body weight to the joints. So if you take a 150-pound person, each stride will impose a load of about 1,200 pounds to the body.
And that goes from the foot to the knee to the hip to the spine, etc.
And that's a lot of weight.
Over the course of a mile, that's tons and tons of impact. So it's an understandable thing that people suspect that that might be harmful to joints.
But what the most recent studies are showing is that for many people, it's not harmful. In a new analysis for Harvard Men's Health Watch, Simon cites three different lines of evidence. In one long-term study, which included about 1,200 residents of the town of Framingham, Massachusetts, researchers looked for a correlation between arthritis and exercise. But what they found?
People who are physically active were no more likely to develop symptoms of arthritis or x-ray evidence of arthritis than people who were sedentary.
And then there's a study from Stanford University that tracked a group of long-distance runners for 20 years. Researchers compared their health to others of similar age who did less exercise. Stanford's Eliza Chakravarti says they expected to find a lot more problems in the runners' knees, but it turns out they had healthier joints at the end of the study.
It does sort of negate the idea that running is universally bad on the knees.
And the other studies negate the idea that moderately intense exercise, including running, leads to a higher risk of arthritis. Stephen Blair is an exercise scientist at the University of South Carolina. He says there are some clear risk factors for osteoarthritis that are related to physical activity.
The primary determinant or the primary predictor of joint injury is a previous injury. You know, you may have damaged something when you were a kid, let's say, that then causes you trouble later on.
If you suffer an injury in a shoulder or knee, you're 2 to 5 times more likely to develop arthritis in that joint. Other risk factors include being overweight, age, or alignment problems. Say if one leg is shorter than the other, this can put unusual stress on the joints. Blair says there are all sorts of individual exceptions, and he says it's important for everyone to be careful and not overdo it. But increasingly, he says, the studies are reminding us that the joints were made for moving. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.